Welcome to the Sleepy Cues podcast, where Linda Schmulowitz
and Jessica Sawicki will share answers to all your questions related to your children's sleep and parenting of young children. We are both certified gentle sleep coaches.
Thanks for tuning in to hear the answers to the many questions that come up with the families we work with.
Hi, welcome to the Sleepy Cues podcast. This is Jessica Sawicki, and I'm here with Linda, and we have a special guest with us today. Our special guest is Katie Holleran. She's a gentle sleep coach as well, but also a behavioral analyst. And we're so, so excited to have her here. Before we go ahead and get started, Katie, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself? Where do you live? Your family?
Sure. Hi, I'm Katie. Thank you guys so much for having me. I live in Washington, D.C., and I live with my husband and my two children who are 11 and 14, and my dog, Zoe.
Nice. So tell us a little bit about how you started working as a behavioral analyst, and also if that's a licensure, if it's a certification, any other qualifications that you have as well.
Absolutely. Way back when, about 20 something years ago, I started my career after college as a teacher and quickly moved from general education classroom to special education. And through that more specific interest, I received my master's in special education. Also, I was living here in Washington, D.C. at that point. So that was at George Washington University. And I was teaching in the classroom while also going through the coursework for my master's in special education. And I worked in, at that point, what was in the early 2000s, they had what they called self-contained classrooms. A lot of education now has moved towards inclusion, where children with any kind of specific diagnosis are included in general education classrooms. The particular school where I worked, things were still very separate. And so I worked next to what was the autism classroom, and they were working with children who mostly were nonverbal, who were limited verbal capacity, but were communicating in other ways, using signs, using gestures, using pictures in communication. And I thought it was very interesting, and I wanted to understand more about how to work with all children that needed various levels of support within the school. And so learned more at that point about a field called ABA, Applied Behavior Analysis. At that point, when you learned about applied behavior analysis, or you became more skilled in that, you then only worked with kids with autism. So, and just to take a quick step back, I usually go back and forth these days between person first language and identity first language. So what that means is, if we say a child with autism, that is a person first. If we say an autistic child, that is identity first. Depending on who I talk with, the reason why I switch back and forth these days is because some parents or folks who have been diagnosed with any particular diagnosis, it doesn't necessarily mean only autism. That was just the example that I used. But I receive a different response every time I ask the question, would you prefer me to use identity first language, or would you prefer me to use person first language? And so it seems as though it's varied in terms of personal preference. So I just ask folks what they prefer. But in a situation like this, when, you know, I'm not sure exactly who's listening and what their preference would be, I'll just go back and forth between the two. So sorry for that kind of sidebar.
Oh, that's really interesting. I hadn't even thought about that. Like,
yeah, it's a really interesting, I would say it's been kind of recent in the last maybe 5 or so years, where I think when I first started, it was very much identity first. When I first started it working in the field of education and special education, it was identity first, you know, autistic kids or whatever the diagnosis was first. And then it seemed to kind of shift. And now we're at a point where I think it really is up to personal preference, which I appreciate. I think is great that we can, you know, let's make sure that we are open to what someone's personal preferences are versus just deciding what it should be. So back to 20-ish years ago, I then started working mostly with autistic individuals. After my master's degree, I went back to school in a program in Penn State University to learn more about behavior analysis. And what that means is just really, really focusing on the science of behavior. So understanding research around behavior and understanding how to support more adaptive behavior in society. So there are behavior analysts like me who work in gambling programs. So if someone is addicted to gambling, we can look at a behavior analytic route of how to support a change if it's becoming a problem in a person's life, how to support a more positive change in their life. Or in weight loss programs or smoking cessation programs. So behavior analysts can kind of work across the gamut of a lot of different areas. It's really looking at, okay, what is my behavior in the world? What am I doing in the world? And behavior meaning anything, talking, speaking, acting, all of those things we qualify as behavior. And so how can we work on creative, more adaptive behavior if it's becoming a maladaptive behavior for a person? And so my particular kind of role within the behavior analytic community is working with children. Now, like I said, in the beginning, it was like, if you were a BCBA, so when I finished my coursework and passed the exam, then I was a board certified behavior analyst. Most BCBAs worked with kids with autism. That was just kind of what it was. So I did start working with a lot of kiddos with autism. And then it became a little bit broader over the past 10, 15 years. It's become a little bit broader. People will say, oh, that sounds, what you're doing with this kiddo, I feel like that could work with another kiddo that's in my classroom or another kiddo down the street, or my niece, I feel like could really benefit from what you're helping me with my kiddo. And that's very accurate. Since most things are behavior, my job is to look at, okay, it's only a problem if it's a problem. And the three of us have heard of that a lot from working with Kim West. And so if you're coming to me with something that the child's harming themselves or others, or they're not able to access their environment the way that perhaps they could be, or there's some sort of barrier to learning or to experiencing the world that we want to try to figure out how we can work on, that's what I do. So that's led me all the way from the classroom to sleep, because sleep is also a behavior. And I'll probably say this 45 times as we keep chatting today, but the way that I look at sleep is just as I look at anything that we can learn one way or another. We can accidentally learn it in a way that maybe isn't the most helpful for a person or those around them, or we can work to reteach and relearn things that maybe would be more successful on many levels. So that's kind of where I'm always thinking, is that kind of broader umbrella of sleep is a learned behavior. How can we kind of fix some puzzle pieces here? And no matter what the kind of diagnostics look like, how can we fix some things and change things and adapt the environment and adapt our responses to create a better environment for everyone?
That's so interesting and super helpful.
Yeah.
So just out of curiosity, do you now work exclusively with children and sleep issues, or are you still working in the classroom at all? I wasn't sure.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know that it's half and half. It depends on the week, but I still am working in schools, both here in Washington, D.C. I am supporting teachers for the most part on what we usually call in the special education world behavior plans or functional behavior plans and functional behavior assessments and behavior intervention plans in the educational world. And then I'm also working with international clients, working with international schools, doing teletherapy. So I work with a group that works with families who are living all over the globe. And so I'm often helping them in homes, whether it's sleep or general behavior related, or helping teachers, again, with mostly teachers either here in DC or in my telehealth practice are for the most part coming to me with a specific behavior that they're finding, you know, concerning or problematic within the school, and looking to work on helping kiddos be more successful within the school.
And so with your sleep consulting practice, what sorts of special needs do you most often encounter there? Things that interfere with children's sleep?
Yeah, it's a hard question to answer because it really depends. One of the things I've been thinking about a lot over the past 5 years when I've started working more and more in the sleep and with kids with special needs area. And there's a saying that was something I learned 20 years ago when I first started working with autistic individuals was, if you know one person with autism, you know one person with autism. And that's the same really for any kiddo and any family. And you know this, both of you know this as sleep coaches, is that, you know, we can have our kind of, okay, this is what you know, 12 months sleep should look like, or 18 months sleep should look like. But we're not just saying to families, oh, here's my one pager on what 18 month old sleep should look like. Go, good luck with that, right? We're saying, okay, what are all the variables here, right? What have you tried that hasn't worked? What does your family system look like? What is housing? What does the environment look like for this child? So it's really the same exercise that I'm working with families, is just kind of, what are all the pieces that are going on? Some of them can be complicated because there could be comorbidities with a diagnosis like ADHD or autism. We could have some medical comorbidities there. So we could have apnea also coming into play, which we need to look at in a very specific lens, right? We're not just going to kind of brush that over and say, well, everything's behavioral. There are specific medical pieces that we might need to look at. I've worked with lots of kiddos with feeding tubes as well. So we have to think very specifically and look very carefully when there's something like a feeding tube, or really any medical condition, to make sure that we're considering everything in the environment.
I've had a couple of kids with feeding tubes. It's been a while, but it definitely did complicate things and made for just another variable that we had to really take into account when we were figuring out the whole plan. So I hear that for sure.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it seems like you work with a variety of special needs kids. The question we had is, which special needs kids have the most difficulty?
I'll tell you kind of how I think about that. I think it really depends. I will say that medical kind of needs. So again, feeding tube, or if we know that a child has apnea, or if we know that a child is coming to me with restless leg, like those are things that we really have to, you know, they can really complicate a child's ability to fall asleep and stay asleep, which is what we're always working, no matter who the kiddo is. In 2019, there was the first study that used a validated measure. So the Children's Sleep Habits Questionnaire, which is a parent report on a variety. I want to say there's like 35 or 38 different questions that families are asked about their child's sleep. And so that was the first time when that validated measure had been used. Most of the time it had been kind of informal. In previous research, it had been informal questions. It had been a very small sample size as well for most of the research until this 2019 article in the American Academy of Pediatrics did. And so what they found, and it was just 2 to 5 year olds. It was about 700 of each population. They did a comparative study, which is also the first time they'd done a comparative study. So all of this is like, this research is very new. You know, we hadn't done any of this before 2019, which is just a couple of years ago. So we're really on the cusp of really understanding this exactly. So in 2019, with those 2 to 5 year olds, they found, according to the sleep questionnaire, that their sleep problems were more than twice as common in young children with autism. They did a combination of autism and then autism plus developmental delays versus the rest of the population. So there were 700 kiddos in each of those categories. And so, you know, more than twice as common having sleep concerns. I think that leads to the answer of your question, Jessica, is just that most of the kiddos, not most, but many of the kiddos, I would say, that I'm working with have a diagnosis of autism or a suspected diagnosis of autism or ADHD. So I think those are kind of the bigger buckets. But again, sometimes it's simply medical, you know, just knowing that we need kind of a little bit more handholding because there's some medical stuff going on here, that those are the kind of areas of need that I see.
So I wonder, do you work with any kids that don't have special needs? Like, do you ever just get like a straight up, you know, straightforward non-special needs sleep related case?
I do. Yeah. For the most part, babies recently, I feel like most of the kids that I work with are kind of one and older. So for the most part, I'm not working as much with babies because we have so many people on our team as gentle sleep coaches who are fantastic with babies. So I know that there's better fits, I think, for families than myself. But really kind of the toddler, any run-of-the-mill toddler, like, I'm in. I love the like 2 to 4 year old set who's just, you know, ready for a good time.
They're the ones that the parents are like, did you get these? My toddler is the most persistent child on the planet.
Yes.
Yes. And I always say you haven't met mine.
Exactly. I did an in-person, this was before the pandemic. I did an in-person consult with a family and we were probably like 45 minutes in, and it was a 3-year-old, and she came and brought me my shoes and was like, bye. Like she could hear that I was like, so this is what we need to do. And I was just like, I got hilarious. You. We are going to be good to go. Like this That's is hilarious. So funny.
That is funny. So I guess, I don't know if you can really answer this question. It's probably too broad, but like, how do you think of working with sort of a typical developing child, you know, without any sort of special needs versus a special needs case?
I think the short answer is just layers. So I'm always looking for kind of what layers can we kind of uncover here, right? So no matter what the kind of profile of the kiddo or the family that's coming to me, there's always multiple layers. I'm always asking lots of questions. What does that look like? How does that feel? We, you know, in our family history forms, we go all the way back to, you know, prenatal care, what the parents experienced, what that looked like, because we know that there are steps along the way that to us are, oh, that's a layer that we're going to need to address, right? If it was a really complicated birth, if it was a really complicated pregnancy, we're going to still, even years later, we still want to make sure that we're uncovering those layers and talking through that, because it does affect how we are as parents. That is anything that's happening that feels stressful or was anxiety provoking at the time, even if we've moved on in time, doesn't mean that it doesn't have an effect on how we parent, right? So I think that for me, that is very similar to when I'm working with parents of kiddos with special needs. It's just, what are the layers happening here, right? So sometimes it's what medical things had to happen for us to even get to this point where you're saying, okay, now I want to work on sleep. Because there's a lot of times where families will say, we were dealing with, you know, 3 different huge medical issues, whether they were emergencies or kind of known things, but they were, you know, they were processes that we had to follow through with our kiddos before we could even say, okay, now we should really focus on sleep, right? So sometimes it's, you know, 4th or 5th thing in the process, we're years and years and years in, which is completely understandable, but I need to kind of understand those layers to know, okay, if your child was in the hospital for some extended amount of time and you weren't able to respond to them, and that was really traumatic for everyone in the family, we're going to need to talk about what that's going to look like in sleep coaching, right? So I'm going to need to tell you about, here's what to expect. Here's kind of some of the things that are going to feel really hard. And then we're going to need to keep talking. So I think that just those layers, what that looks like, I think is really important to me. I've kind of learned this along the way in the last few years, is to be better about listening and to be better about saying, okay, how did that feel? And sometimes I'm taking really small steps. And I think that that's probably the biggest difference, is that there's a lot of adaptation of steps. So if we think about something like the shuffle, which I know your listeners will be familiar with, you know, if we think about that kind of every 3 days-ish we're moving, the ish is really important in the families that I work with. So to me, the science isn't necessarily in the 3 days, it's in finding that balance. So how can we make sure we're supporting the kiddo and the parents, the caregivers for that matter, while also making a little bit of a push away so we can teach that skill? And I'm always talking with parents about, I'm okay if we take the babiest of baby steps. If we move from 6 inches away to 8 inches away as our next step from the bed or the crib or wherever we might be, that's fine with me. It's really finding that balance between support, but also providing our kiddos the opportunity to practice. So I really kind of lean on my philosophy of, we are teaching a skill. And when whatever you might be teaching a child, whether it's if they're at a point developmentally where they can learn how to use a utensil to eat, if they're at a point developmentally when they can crawl or they can walk, let's say the walking example, we're not just standing our kiddos up and saying, good luck, see how that goes, right? We're holding, we're using a lot of physical prompting when our kiddos first start walking. We're holding their hands fully. Then we move to the like one hand. Then we move to that little like one finger move that we do, right? Where our kiddos are just grasping onto that. We're not just kind of, you know, standing them up and saying good luck. So this is the same process. And to me, it doesn't matter what the steps are and kind of where exactly they are. It's that we're there, we're supporting, and then we're making progress. So if that means 4 or 5 nights in one spot, and then we really move, you know, incremental movement could mean inches. That's great. We're gonna do that. But figuring out where we can be consistent is huge. And then also just providing that opportunity to practice. And I think it's easy to get stuck and feel like, well, that's just too big of a jump. And so I will ask parents to kind of, okay, just give me 2 nights, right? Give me 2 nights. We're going to do this for 2 nights. We're going to see how it goes. And then we're going to check in again and see where it was. Because the first night can often be really hard, right? So we're going to talk after the first night, but I'm not going to say change everything after the first night, because we need to give it more than that. Sometimes I'll ask, depending on the family, I'll ask them to give me 4 nights. You know, I just say like, let's work in these small chunks of time and take incremental steps as we can. And then my job is to keep looking at this from that larger view and saying, okay, we're still making progress, even if it might not feel like that to the family. So I don't know if that's helpful to kind of hear the process, but I think it's really about adapting the steps if we need to, and adapting speed at which we have to move through things. So I'm often working with families for a longer time, you know, 4 to 6 weeks is certainly a pretty basic amount of time that I'm working with families, if not longer, up to, you know, a few months of time that we're working together to just really get through those steps. If it needs to take us longer, then that's great.
Mm-hmm. No, that's really helpful, because I mean, Linda and I are coaches, as you know, but like, this is unfamiliar territory. So for me, it's like, oh my God, is it possible? I don't know. And it's great to hear that from you, that it is possible. You know, it's just a little bit different. It's a little bit slower, and it is attainable. It's just a little bit different, which is also very normal to hear in general, because every child is different, right? So every process is going to be a little bit different. Do you find that children with special needs always struggle with sleep, or are there things that cause the most problems with sleep?
It's a good question. I will say that the kind of biggest buckets that I work on, I think, are probably pretty similar across the sleep coaching experience. It is falling asleep at bedtime is one bucket that I'm always working on. It is staying asleep overnight. That is another bucket. And then it is the early risings. Now, sometimes kiddos will choose all 3 buckets, right? So we're working on all the things. And sometimes there will be kind of 1 or 2. And there isn't any kind of, oh, I know if it, you know, as a kiddo with this specific diagnosis, it's always going to be, you know, falling asleep at bedtime. I don't see those kind of patterns. I think that when I see things in terms of the falling asleep at night, oftentimes what I'm seeing is just the duration, or what we might call latency, between the time we say, okay, good night, it's time to fall asleep, and whatever the bedtime routine is, to a child actually falling asleep. So sometimes that can take hours and hours. Even night wakings, I often am working with families where it's not just kind of 1 or 2 wake ups ish, and it just kind of takes a little bit of time. It can be hours. It can be kiddos, you know, being awake for 3 hours at night, which again isn't necessarily diagnosis specific, but it just seems to me that it's the same issues that we all work on. It just seems more intense in one way or another. Either it's, you know, just so much crying and screaming, and it just is a terrible experience for all, or it's just incredibly long. You know, it's just kiddos are just not tired, and they just really have a hard time kind of winding down. So it just seems more intense to me that when I'm working with clients with specific diagnoses, or again, that are families who are coming to me with it, maybe a suspected diagnosis, or just looking at or wondering what might be going on developmentally or sensory wise, wondering kind of what that look is looking like for my kiddo.
So my question actually kind of plays into that whole sleep latency issue, which is, there's a lot of talk about using melatonin for helping their child sleep. And what I usually say is, if there's a behavioral issue, melatonin isn't going to solve your problem. But where you do hear more that it is useful is for kids with autism. And so I was curious how that plays into your work. Do you see a lot of families coming to you who are using melatonin, and how does that play out?
Yeah, for sure. I've started trying to work with pediatricians on this too, because I think one of the first answers that when a parent is talking with a pediatrician, and it makes sense, right? We should all be able to talk to our pediatricians about all the things, and sleep should be included. I think right now the kind of first step seems to be to try melatonin for a lot, not necessarily all, but for a lot of pediatricians. And so a lot of families, I should probably know percentage of families that are coming to me asking for support, but who have already started melatonin, but it's a pretty high percentage of families who have been trying melatonin. I think that the research is, again, this is a really new area of research, melatonin. And so that just in and of itself just gives me a little bit of a pause of the widespread usage of it. Really what we're not sure is there's a timing, like when you give it. I think you have to really work very carefully with a pediatrician about, okay, when do we give the melatonin? How long do we need to give it time to work out? How much do we give? I think there's a lot that's, you know, it's no big deal. Just give it a try. And like, what does that mean? What's that supposed to look like? And I think parents can be easily confused about when I'm supposed to give it, how much I'm supposed to give, and how quickly should I see, you know, is it tonight that when I've started the first time, then I should see them just, you know, sleeping soundly within 20 minutes, or what am I supposed to look for, you know? So I think that there's families who come to me who will say, we tried melatonin, it actually helped them fall asleep a little bit faster, but the wake-ups are still happening, but they're still waking up at 4 a.m. and just awake for the day. So I think that while there may be some, and this is all anecdotal evidence at this point, so it's really important for me to say that there isn't enough research for me to say what the research is telling us yet, but the anecdotal evidence that I have is that I'm seeing that maybe parents are reporting that they're falling asleep faster at the bedtime part. Faster could be 1 hour instead of 2 hours, right? It's not, oh, they're just immediately falling asleep. There's still a long latency there often, but they're still coming and saying, but there's still these pieces that I can't figure out why, you know, melatonin's not solving the overnight, melatonin's not solving the early rising. So what's that about? And I think I agree with you, Linda, that for me, that's when I'm, again, that behavioral piece of, you know, I'm thinking that this skill is not being learned. So I ask families to work with me. I don't ask them to not do the melatonin. You can keep doing what you're doing, but we're going to work on this skill of falling asleep, whether it's bedtime, overnight, early rising, all three. We're going to work on this skill. And I have had many families, and this is another thing that I should probably know, like the numbers, but I have had a lot of families who then say, once we get through the process and their kids are learning to fall asleep on their own, say, hey, guess what? We stopped doing melatonin a couple of weeks ago and we need it. We realize we don't need it.
So it's behold.
Yeah, exactly. It's really, really interesting. I think I get it though. Like, if I was having a struggle and I was exhausted and my kiddo was exhausted and you said, here, try this, I'd be like, sure, I'll do anything like that. Sure, I can do that. We can get the melatonin gummy, whatever it might be. I'm in. But I think that we do, if we're just masking an underlying issue that's not being addressed by that learning to fall asleep and learning that skill, then unfortunately it's not going to be that fix that we're hoping for.
I always tell my clients, because they give them melatonin and my child's still waking up, I'm like, melatonin isn't a sleeping drug. Like, right. It's not going to knock your child out for 12 hours, right? Like, right. It gets them to fall asleep easier, but the point of the melatonin is not to keep your child sleeping the whole night. Mm-hmm. So I agree with you. They still need to learn the behavior if the behavioral issue is still there.
Exactly.
It's also sort of like thinking of how I think of using any kind of like a bedtime fading approach where you're pushing bedtime later so that your child is actually really tired. But then once they're falling asleep more easily and you have less resistance, you can start to bring it earlier and see, oh, now you have the skill. Now it's not a struggle. Now we can do what we would have wanted to do before, whether it's putting you to bed at a more reasonable hour or not giving you melatonin.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And bedtime feeding is a really, really helpful tool with kiddos with that long latency, especially if it's really intense. So if it's, you know, my kiddo's really just struggling for 2 hours, you know, there's crying, there's screaming, there's flopping on the ground, there's head banging, whatever it might be, you know, that's just really intense to say to a parent, okay, would you just sit right next to them while they do that for 2 hours? Like, that's just going to be, no, thank you. No one's going to want to do that. And that's not helpful for anyone, right? So I love the bedtime feeding because I'll often do that, especially with my older kiddos, where that behavior kind of becomes pretty intense at the bedtime, you know, really start and you kind of see it click, right? When you can start to see it click, then you can move that bedtime a little bit earlier and earlier. And then again, you're in a space where you have the opportunity to teach that skill. And it's really hard when it's, you know, super intense behavior. It's hard to say, oh, this is a great opportunity to teach something.
One area that we haven't really spoken about that we're really interested in about, and my older son has or had it, is SPD, sensory processing disorder. So mine was and is a sensory seeker. Luckily, sleep is there. Obviously, there's ups and downs like every child, but it's there. So definitely affects his behavior and his sleep. But can you give us any general guidance that you can offer with children who have SPD as it relates to their sleep?
Absolutely. I think there's a couple things. I really think that that is a very common thread, no matter what kind of diagnostics or whatever what we're kind of thinking about that might be going on with a kiddo. The idea that the way kids are taking in the world and the way that the environment is affecting them one way or another can't be overstated. To me, I really ask parents to describe what different parts of the day look like when they say, I know we have some sensory things going on. Just ask them to tell me what that looks like, right? So whether it's bedtime related or just when you're out in the world, what does that look like? How is your kiddo experiencing this particular time of day or this particular part of the world? And that gives us a lot of clues if we can kind of hone in on what reaction your kiddo is having to a particular, whatever it might be. Sound, light, feeling, whatever it might be. What do you see your kiddos seeking out a lot, right? Do you see them like always wanting to swing or rock or bounce? You know, what are you noticing about their bodies that it seems like they need to kind of regulate? So much of teaching sleep is teaching kiddos how to self-regulate. And it becomes really difficult when there's other layers going on and maybe you don't even know. Or when a kiddo can't communicate with you, hey, this feels good. You have to just really be a detective and watch. Oh, that seems to feel good because I see them get more calm when they do this. I try to look at what those things are that seem to help a child, that seem to help to regulate a child. I will see how we can incorporate those into bedtime. So I work a lot with occupational therapists and I love, love, love working with occupational therapists. So if a kiddo already has a team and an occupational therapist is on it, I'm like, fantastic. Let's go. Let's talk to the occupational therapist, bring them into the consult, or I want to email them. Like, let's figure out what's going on in terms of when they're working with a child, they'll already have a whole sensory profile. So they can say they're a seeker of this. They need to avoid this. I can get there with families too, but it's really helpful to kind of have that broad view from an OT. And then we can say, okay, then what would be helpful to bring in to the bedtime? And so Kim and I did write a workbook for kids with special needs, and we have a couple of exercises in there. One is the hot dog, where kids can get kind of rolled up into a yoga mat, and you can do like ketchup and mustard, and then you put the bun on and you're doing sensory work at that time. You're kind of giving a massage, but different kinds of movement along a child's back to really get some of that sensory feedback if that's helpful for kiddos. If there's like a sensory, you know, swinging helps, if that's something that you notice helps a kiddo during the day or at other times of day, what can we do to bring that into bedtime? Even if you can't install a swing in your basement or in your kid's room or something, like, you know, in the old days, I remember having a sheet and having a parent on each side and they'd swing you back and forth, right? So how can we kind of create that environment for a kiddo creatively so that we can really get those needs met? Because I think that's the biggest thing. What needs can we help to provide for a child. And I usually see if we can do that as part of the bedtime or just right before bedtime to really get those needs met and for a child to be at his or her most regulated state when we're working on that bedtime. So, you know, there's tons of things. And I would say really partnering with occupational therapists is key if you're noticing that your child is really having trouble regulate in certain areas or certain times of the day, whether it's sleep or not. I think that that can be hugely beneficial. There's occupational therapists do what's called a sensory profile measure, and they can really look at all of the pieces of your child's profile and really understand what's going on. And then they can say, okay, great. Here's what we see from the sensory profile. And then here are some exercises for you to try. And you can incorporate most of those into a bedtime routine to really help your child be at his or her most regulated state.
I have a follow-up question. Weighted blankets. Mm-hmm. So a lot of children need it, but there's also a lot of children that don't. And so a lot of parents will go to the weighted blanket. So if you can give us your thoughts about the weighted blanket, that would be super helpful for our listeners.
Can get them at Target now. It yes. used to be they were like a medical device.
Right. It was like go to some very specific website and get, yeah, absolutely. No, it's definitely a thing. And it's kind of similar to my answer about melatonin is that I think that they can be super, super helpful. I think that there's no harm in trying it. I think as long as you're being very safe. So there's an actual, and of course, I don't know exactly the percentage. There's an actual formula to follow of how heavy you want a weighted blanket to be based on your kiddo's weights, right? And we have it in our book and I just don't have it open to that page.
It says it actually on the package. I know this because my son wanted for camp this summer. I was like, fine, if you want it, that thing is really heavy. You're going to schlep that to camp. But it says on the side of the package, you know, based on your weight, this is what weight you should use.
Good. Glad that that's a regulated thing mm-hmm. because I think that's the key, right? Like, I don't want to suggest something that's unsafe for your kiddo. Mm-hmm. So, and then, you know, Give it a whirl. Sure. Let's see how it goes. I will say, and this is the same thing with melatonin, if there are underlying issues around knowing how to fall asleep independently, I'm not sure a weighted blanket is going to be the magic one that you're hoping it's going to be. But at the same time, it is a very, very helpful tool. So I think that if it works and if it helps, it can be very helpful for kiddos. I don't want it to sound like I'm dissuading someone. I think it's really important to kind of set expectations that it could be very, I see that they're more relaxed, but they're still not asleep, right? So that's great. That's one step. That's one step to self-regulation and to being able to fall asleep independently is to feel comfortable. And if we're looking at, again, any of those heightened sensory pieces, you know, just being able to get comfortable is a hurdle in and of itself. So if that helps a kiddo feel comfortable, then we're just that much further along in the ability to teach that skill. So I think a lot of a weighted blanket is probably trial and error, but certainly, again, if you work with an OT or if your kiddo works with an OT, you know, that's a good question for them to say, and they would know, oh yes, I do see kind of deep compression or deep hugs actually feel good for my kiddo. Or if you notice that a kiddo's coming in really, really wants a tight squeeze, then that might be a good indication that that would feel really good for your kiddo. But I don't think it would be something that we could put in place of teaching the skill, but it could really help your kiddo to just be that much more ready to learn that skill, if that makes sense.
It also reminds me, I've seen those compression sheets. Jess, have you seen those? It's like a really tight like a sheet.
Sock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like a big right. body sock kind of thing.
Yeah. I saw one at somebody's house once. I was like, oh, that is interesting. How do you get into that?
And they have ones now. I saw, I think my Instagram feed knows what I do. So there was one that's like a compression sock. And then it even has like a spot for you to put your feet out. Cause I always think like, oh, that looks so hot. Then if you're hot in the middle of the night, then what? So there's one that like, you can like flip your little feet out. So that could be helpful for kiddos too.
Yeah. I mean, I think of those kids, I see this a lot where the parent is laying down with their child and the child needs their parent to be like wrapped around them. And we'll talk about how, okay, you know, your child needs you to fall asleep with them or to be there to fall asleep. And now we're working on having you not be there. But if they're seeking that intense pressure on their body, what can we do so that they can be able to tolerate being by themselves, but also maybe have that pressure. And so that I've had that conversation come up for sure.
Exactly. I think it's a really good way if you do notice that, especially at bedtime, being in need, that you can kind of, that's a great way to kind of take those small steps, but still providing that support, right?
Yeah. So really our last question I want to ask, but I did want to just make a point, and you mentioned it before, but I want to make a point to mention that you did write a book with Kim about working with kids with special needs who also have sleep issues. And so for anybody who's listening to this, who is wondering, how do I get more help besides contacting Katie, which we will include all of her contact information in the show notes. But also I would check out that book, which I'll include a link to that as well, because I think that that's probably got a lot of really helpful information in it. But just in general, is there anything that we didn't ask you about, anything that you feel like it would be helpful for parents who have children with special needs to hear and to just know, okay, there is hope, my child can become a better sleeper?
I think that it was interesting, you mentioned this before, that many times parents are reluctant to talk with me or to think about sleep coaching, because I think parents might feel like this is just what it is. I have a kiddo with this, or I have a kiddo with that, or I have a kiddo who needs more of this than other kids. And so I guess sleep is just going to go by the wayside. And I think I would encourage folks to shift that thinking a little bit and just ask, you know, is this something that we could work on? Most of the time it is. There are some times where I will say to families, it looks like we need to work on some medical pieces before we work on the behavioral side, before we work on that skill of falling asleep. If there's something that's really going to be in the way medically, let's work on that. Why don't you guys, you know, focus on that, and then let's come back. But 9 times out of 10, I will have families that come and say, well, but they just really need this more than any other kiddo I've ever met. Or they're just, you know, really, really unique in the situation. Like, no other kid is up for 3 hours in the middle of the night, right? And I'll say, actually, I've worked with plenty. Mm-hmm. And so I think just not feeling like this is the only kiddo who has this need, and also that it doesn't have to be that way, I think is the biggest kind of message, is that, you know, we really can work on most of the things that we see at bedtime and overnight and in the early morning hours. It might be, like I said, gradual. It might take a good long time. We might do it in phases. I have families that I'll work with for, you know, 6 or 8 weeks or so. We'll work on kind of one thing, and then we'll come back. We'll take a minute, and then we'll break, and then we'll come back, you know, 6 months, a year, and we'll work on kind of the next piece that we feel like we're ready to tackle. All of those things are absolutely perfect and fine to do. I think that just realizing that you can take small steps, you can do it. And it isn't just, oh, if I have this diagnosis, or if I have this particular need that I'm seeing my kiddo has, then it just means that nobody's going to sleep forever. Because it's usually not the case.
Well, that's really reassuring and helpful for at least me, and I'm sure our listeners as well, because, you know, lack of sleep, as we all know, can take a toll on all of us. That's very positive. So thank you for being with us today. It was super helpful, super insightful, and at least I know for Linda and I, and I'm sure our listeners. So thank you. We will definitely include links to all your information so that our listeners out there can reach out to you if they have any questions. So thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity, and it was really great chatting with you.